When we walk around a city, how often do we think about what lies underneath our feet, underneath the layers of concrete, sand, and asphalt? When I was working on a tree planting project recently, I learned that many streets in Baltimore are paved over oyster shells. It was strange to watch the pavement being ripped up and to see the sand mixed with these crunched up oyster shells. Some streets are paved over riverbeds, over the crumbling remnants of old houses. Think of the door handles, the window panes. Who touched them? Who built them? I'm Katie Marquette, and you're listening to the original WYPR podcast, The Noir and Bizarre. On this show, we like to ask questions about the eerie and the strange, the miraculous and the just plain odd. Well, Adam Dromberg, an independent producer here in Baltimore, started asking questions about what lies beneath some of his favorite places in the city. First on the list was the famous Lexington Market. Okay, when I say catacombs, what do you think of? I think of those eerie tombs in Rome and Paris, complicated and beautiful, and very spooky, ancient graves. Well, catacombs can also refer to an underground construction site, complicated interworkings of tunnels and vaults. On this episode, I'm handing the mic over to Adam Dromberg and his co-producer, Calvin Perry. They're taking us deep underground and back in time.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve?
They're demons! They're demons!
Experience the excitement, the danger.
But it would be slightly more difficult to pull off now, though, don't you think?
3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Adam Dromberg.
I'm Calvin Perry.
And today on this episode of The Noir and the Bizarre, Katie Marquette has been kind enough and brave enough to hand the microphone over to us.
Thanks, Katie.
And today we are going to be bringing you a story from Lexington Market.
So for those that don't know, the Lexington Market is the oldest public market in America. It was founded in 1782 in Baltimore. Originally, it was a big open field where farmers could roll up a cart and sell their produce. It's had several buildings there since then. Some have burned down. And the new one we're on right now is beautiful. And if you're coming to Baltimore, you got to come to the market. It's my favorite place in Baltimore by far.
It's a lot of people's favorite place. I mean, it's been around for so long. And because of that reason, a couple years ago, we decided to do an audio tour of the Lexington Market, kind of like a museum tour with sound. And during our research into the market's history, we discovered that there were actually catacombs underneath the market. And I basically kept pestering the market manager, Stacy Pacht, until she let myself and a photographer go underground and check it out for ourselves. And what you're about to hear is the original story that we recorded. We're going to let that play out. But while I was down underground, Calvin was doing some research and found out that there is a much bigger story there than we even thought. So we're going to let this play out, and Calvin and I will see you on the other side.
See you then.
The catacombs under the West Building at Lexington Market are so old that many in the city had forgotten about them, until they were again accidentally discovered during the construction of the market's parking garage. During the month of January in 1951, when construction began on the parking garage adjacent to Lexington Market, workers were surprised to break into a three-story deep underground tunnel, spanning 100 feet long with six chambers branching off of it. Shortly after the discovery, the very next day actually, with the specter of the Cold War present in the public's mind, the state civil defense director, Lieutenant Colonel David G. McIntosh, proposed making the catacombs into a bomb shelter. He had hoped to have the local civil defense director, Paul L. Holland, survey the system of vaults and tunnels. However, this never came to be. Instead, the main tunnel system was sealed over, and the space continued to gather dust while the market went on about its business. In 2016, we went underground to explore the place for ourselves. We got into the catacombs through an old abandoned restaurant called Tubbs, which is still sitting in the basement of the West Market, untouched. The restaurant closed in 1988, after losing its liquor license for having go-go dancers. Now, the space seems stuck in time, with bright red carpets from the 70s and a sign offering Miller Lite at 50 cents.
They must have had a, like you said, a wedding or something down here, all these little bits of confetti everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Or it might have been the last party.
No more dancers, no crab cake sandwiches, just a carnival tent backdrop and some dishware heaped up in corners, as if whoever was cleaning the place gave up halfway through.
Man, just plates and everything just laid. It's like
This is what always kind of astonishes me about these places that get abandoned like this. It's like the last day, just the restaurant stopped, everything stopped where it was, and then stuff just slowly kind of migrates over time of people coming in and out.
Towards the back of the restaurant, behind a heavy steel door, some old concrete steps lead underground into the catacombs.
Okay, yeah, this is starting to look more like a catacomb.
Catacombs are empty and abandoned now. The underground space is pitch dark with high, echoey ceilings. So even if you turn off your flashlight, you still know you're in a big room by the sound of your own voice.
Yeah, I think I've managed to hit every single cobweb in this basement.
Just a large, empty room with almost no evidence of what has happened.
But as we've come to find out, there's actually a lot that's happened down there in the catacombs of the Lexington Market. The tunnels have a long and winding history.
Well, a lot of bizarre things.
Definitely. A lot of weird circumstances have happened. Stuff that's almost hard to believe, actually.
Yeah. So while I was down in the catacombs recording what you just heard, we recorded that a little while ago for an audio tour of the Lexington Market. While I was down there getting covered in cobwebs, Calvin was doing some research, and he actually came across a couple of interesting stories and one really crazy story.
Yeah, so starting on the stuff that's a little bit easier to believe, despite the city government forgetting about these tunnels until they were rediscovered by the construction crew that Adam talked about earlier when they were making the parking garage, it was still knowledge in the community around the market. So in the 1950s, after the tunnels were rediscovered, the Baltimore Sun did an article on it, and a local resident named Lester N. Schaefer was quoted in the article about saying how he and his friends would play snowball fights or half snowball fights down in the tunnels in the 20s when it was like 100 degrees outside. And then they would go down there and shoot rats with their 22 rifles, as kids in the 20s apparently did to have fun.
The rat population was probably a little lower back in the 20s. We also discovered that during Prohibition time, so the tunnels weren't completely forgotten about, because during Prohibition, down in the cellars, they had an illegal whiskey distillery. In February of 1932, the catacombs were raided by Prohibition agents. They were following the scent of fermenting mash to lead them to the distillery. And when they got there, they found one of the largest whiskey stills on the East Coast. It was worth over $100,000. And was that $100,000 1920 money?
That's now money.
That's now money. Okay.
So it was a lot.
Okay. I would say that 1920 money, that's an industry.
Yeah. No, for real. Actually, wait. Let me check that. I made a snap judgment. Yeah. $100,000 1920s money.
Okay. So it was $100,000 1920s money. Wow. Okay. So they found this still in the cellars worth over $100,000. As the agents were going in, the bootleggers were running out of the other side of the tunnel, and in total, the agents found a 20,000-gallon still, 300,000 gallons of mash, and 18,000 gallons of alcohol. Once they found it, they took all the equipment, dragged it into the alley, and ripped it apart with axes.
Yeah, so originally, before the tunnels were a place for illegal whiskey brewing, it was a place where the market vendors would slaughter and cure their meats, and there were large refrigeration coils on the walls. So over the years, it just became a place for storage. But according to multiple Baltimore Sun articles from the 1930s.
Wait, well, hold on. The 1930s, that was during the...
Yeah, the Red Scare. Yeah. Exactly.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist.
Communism was on the rise, and America was on this crusade to basically shut down any and all communist activities, ideas.
Exactly, yeah. So the Red Scare, it was...
Hold on, let's get us back into the 1930s here.
Okay. Nice. All right, okay. We're back in the 1930s.
So, as you were saying...
So, during the Red Scare, the head of the House Committee for Investigating Communist Activities, a man by the name Mr. Fish, led a raid through the tunnels. Mr. Fish actually founded the committee when he was a congressman for New York in 1930. He introduced some legislation to found a group and lead investigations on individuals or groups suspected of participating in communist activities in the U.S. This committee was actually one of the inspirations for the House Un-American Activities Committee, founded in 1936.
Calling the House Un-American Activities Committee to order.
The same committee that hounded and blacklisted Hollywood actors for being supposedly communist.
The committee is seeking to determine if Red Party members have reached the screen with subversive propaganda.
A long list of prominent motion picture witnesses appear before the committee.
Closer to the Salem witch trials than an actual fair trial.
If communists have attempted to inject their propaganda into the motion picture, they have failed miserably. We will never permit them to succeed.
So Mr. Fish, with his committee at his back, led a raid through the tunnels for three trunks of documents that had been stolen from his committee by a man named Gustin B. Means.
So this is where I actually made a mistake. When I originally read the article, I mistook an A for the letter U, and we thought the suspect in question was Gustin B. Means, a name that got us nowhere. It meant nothing. When we looked a little closer, it turns out his name was actually Gaston B. Means, a very famous criminal at the time. And for those of you unfamiliar with Gaston B. Means, here's just some of the things he was involved in. Forgery, espionage, private investigations,
defrauding the U.S. government, bootlegging. He also played a part in the Lindenberg kidnapping.
Gaston B. Means adds this whole new dimension to the story. Mr. Fish wasn't just looking for some nameless criminal, but a criminal that Edgar Hoover called the most amazing figure in contemporary criminal history.
Yeah, so because of Gaston B. Means' reputation as a notorious criminal, Mr. Fish didn't even bother going through the proper channels of letting anyone know he was conducting the raid. The police commissioner at the time, Charles D. Gaither, was quoted as saying, "I was asked to give police protection for the raid, which I did. Further than that, I know nothing. It was a government affair." He wasn't the only one in the dark, though. Supposedly, there was no warrant for the raid, and even the United States attorney didn't know it was even happening.
So if no one knew this was happening, how did Mr. Fish know the documents Mr. Means stole were even there?
Supposedly, there was a receipt made out to Gaston B. Means for the delivery of the documents to the warehouse that was above the catacombs at the time.
You mean to tell me that an international spy and career criminal was so careless that he used his real name for the delivery?
Well, I mean, that's if you believe what Mr. Fish said.
Wait, what do you mean?
So, all this is just based on a statement that Mr. Fish made, that he said he presented the delivery slip to the commission he was ahead of for evidence to do the raid.
But he didn't?
Well, I mean, no. It was the Red Scare. It was like sort of anything goes. Nobody was clean.
So he supposedly presents this slip as evidence for the raid. What actually happened when he got down there?
Okay, so with the Baltimore police blocking the street above the ground, Mr. Fish and his team went into the catacombs. They found several crates, which they dragged up into the alley, and under Mr. Fish's orders began tearing them apart with crowbars in search of the documents. No communist propaganda was found. All they found, and I'm totally serious here, was lettuce.
Lettuce?
Yeah, just crates and crates of lettuce. No communist propaganda.
So, when the Baltimore Sun got wind of this whole story, what was the title for the article that day?
Mr. Fish attends fruitless raid.
Okay, I think that's my favorite part of this whole.
I know, right? The editor definitely got a raise that day.
Definitely.
So, what's going on in the catacombs now, Adam, since you've been there?
So, when I first went down, I had to go through Tubbs Restaurant, which, as you heard earlier, was filled with broken plates and glass and was really just a mess. And when you got down into the catacombs, it was completely pitch black, void of light. There were cobwebs everywhere. Now, since then, they've cleaned up Tubbs Restaurant. They've gotten all the broken plates and glass out. The catacombs actually have lights and everything down there because Stacy Pack, the market manager, has actually started leading tours down into the catacombs. It's become sort of a tourist attraction since we originally aired the story. So next time you're in Baltimore, you can go to the Lexington Market and you can go down into the catacombs and
stand where Mr. Fish once stood, ripping apart crates of lettuce.
So is that everything?
That's everything. I'm Adam Droneberg.
I'm Calvin Perry.
Thank you for listening.
London town had me low, had me down.
Hey, Katie Marquette back on the mic here. Thanks so much to Adam and Calvin for bringing us that fascinating story. Just goes to show the amazing things you find out when you ask questions like, hey, I wonder what's under there. The research they put into that story was incredible. Thanks again, guys. So before we wrap up, I have a question for you. What do you think of when you think of death? Like personified death, death as a person. I'm guessing you have some vision of a skeletal figure in a black hooded robe holding a scythe. Well, when I think of death, I think of Brad Pitt. Yes, that Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt, formerly of Angie and Brad, the very same. And if you are one of the few people who have seen the movie Meet Joe Black, you know I'm not just talking crazy. And if you haven't seen this movie, that's your homework for the month before the next episode drops. Watch this movie. Yes, it is very long. Yes, Brad Pitt has greasy-looking hair, and yes, he takes off his shirt at some point. All these details are irrelevant. But here's the premise. Death decides to take a holiday. He kills off a good-looking guy and inhabits his body. Anthony Hopkins' character is an older man who's had a good life. Death makes a deal with him. More time on Earth if he allows Death to hang around for a while in order to understand what this mortality thing is all about.
Your death. Death. That's me. You're not death, you're just a kid in a suit.
The suit came with the body I took.
Let me ask your opinion. Do I blend in?
I love this movie. And it got me to thinking about personifications of death throughout history and across different cultures. Sometimes death rides a pale horse. Sometimes death is an angel. Sometimes death is an old washerwoman with a bloody rag. Sometimes death is a tall, thin man in a wide hat who goes around collecting souls. We'll learn all about the history of death personified. That's next time on The Noir and Bizarre. The Noir and Bizarre is an original WYPR production, hosted and produced by me, Katie Marquette. Until next time, thanks for listening.